Hi, everyone. Welcome to another episode of What It's Like. And we interview folks from all over the place about their personal life experiences. Let me give my typical disclaimer. This is one person's story of their experience with this area. Somebody else might have had a very different experience doing the exact same thing. But this gives us a little bit of a window into what it might be like for somebody to do this. So I'd like to go ahead and welcome our guest for today. Thank you so much for joining us on the podcast, Jacob.
Thank you for having me, Hannah.
Yeah, absolutely. So tell us in a sentence or two, sort of the elevator pitch, what is the experience that you're going to be sharing with our listeners today?
Sure. Well, it's funny you mentioned elevator pitch because it is, in fact, about starting a startup and the experience of founding a company, having the idea, and taking it all the way from like conception to raising money, growing the team, and scaling it internationally.
Yeah. I guess I want to start by asking the business that you're talking about today, was this the first business that you started? Did you have previous ones before this?
It was actually, yeah, it was the first.
Awesome. So yeah, tell me about what made you decide to what was the inception of this idea?
Well, I guess it probably goes back to when I was studying. I read economics at Oxford, and I met my very good friend, Anthony, who's now my business partner. And we got on really well. Both were very interested in entrepreneurship in general. It was around the time as well that like Airbnb and Uber were really starting to take off. So they were kind of going from, in Europe at least, they were going from like, you know, fairly interesting new startups to almost like household names. And we got really interested in that kind of sharing economy business model. So that was something we used to talk about a lot. And then when we graduated, both of us had, we got together and we said, you know what, this is a really good year. Let's try and come up with something this year while we've got no other commitments. We're not earning anything that's going to like, you know, anchor us at higher salaries. That's not to say that that doesn't work. I know loads of people who've gone and worked in different businesses for a few years, built up some experience and then gone on to found companies. But I guess we were just kind of itching to get going and didn't want to sort of fall into the golden handcuffs of a successful career, if you like. Anyway, so that's the kind of like, that's where we found ourselves summer of 2015. I was going on to do a master's for the year and was working in a digital marketing agency. We both moved to London. Ant was living particularly centrally. So he was based between Euston and King's Cross. And I don't know if you're familiar with the city, but they're like two of the busiest stations in the whole of London. And he often had requests from people saying, do you mind if I leave this with you? Can you look after my stuff for a bit? Or do you mind if I leave this here? And we found he was like sort of inadvertently kind of running this mini storage business. And we got together and we're like, do you know what? There might be something in this. Like Airbnb is growing more popular, as we mentioned. And it kind of started as a bit of a joke, but we're like, there could be something in this sort of Airbnb for storage model. And that was really the original idea. And we've developed it a little bit since then, but that was where it started.
Oh, that's really fascinating. So as you were kind of planning this out, what were some of the research that you did into similar businesses? Was there anything else that had been like this?
That's a good question. Because I think I've definitely had this experience before where I've thought of an idea and been like, oh my God, this is it. This is like a mega great idea. And you look online and you're like, oh, okay, someone's already done it. And in this case, we found that what was really interesting was, so when we started it, we were like, anyone can store anything for as long as they like in our flats or anywhere that we can list on the website. And to begin with, it was literally our apartments and friends and family who we could persuade to sign up their apartments, which some of them did pretty reluctantly. They were like, I'll put it on there, but can you set it so that like no one can actually leave stuff with me? Anyway, so we had that set up and we started looking into the storage business, and we found self-storage is very well catered to, particularly in the UK, definitely in the USA as well. Although we have seen some pretty cool startups break into that space. But self-storage was pretty well catered for. So we thought, I wonder if we can undercut these guys, possibly. The real advantage we seem to be seeing was that, you know, they're kind of real estate businesses. They have to find land, set up these big warehouses, and we're like, let's just take advantage of existing space. So we should be able to do things a bit cheaper. What was interesting though, and inadvertently, this was kind of like by the startup playbook, although really at the time it was just us kind of doing what felt sort of natural. We built the platform and let people start using it and just kind of like watch the customers to see how they wanted it. And what was really interesting was everyone who was using it was not using it for like a month as we'd sort of imagined, but using it for like a day. They were basically taking it as an alternative to lockers. And a lot of it was Airbnb guests who had checked out and didn't have anywhere to keep their stuff. People going to football matches, concerts, events, people visiting London just for the day who didn't want to be dragging all their stuff around with them for the whole afternoon while they were doing whatever activities they were getting up to. And this was really interesting to us because we're like, hang on, self-storage, as we said, it's a bit crowded. There are plenty of people operating in this space. But the only solution to the short-term storage that we found were station lockers. And there were only a handful of them left. They were really expensive. And we just figured at that point, we're like, okay, this is a niche. We've found a new niche in the market and this is what we're going to go after. And that was pretty cool, that moment where we sort of realized we'd actually stumbled on something that had potential.
Yeah. Okay. So you have an idea, you've done your research, you found that this is kind of it is a niche, it's its own thing. So what was the next step? Did you start looking at raising money? Did you evaluate what kind of costs you would need? What was the next step for you?
So for us, the main thing was we really wanted to kind of get proof of concept. Before we thought about raising, we just wanted to make sure that this business was really viable. And one of the big challenges for us was actually kind of the supply side of this marketplace. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, to this day, we still think of it as a marketplace. We have on the one hand, the businesses, because they are all businesses now, who provide storage space. And then on the other hand, the people who need somewhere to keep their things. And at the beginning, as I mentioned, it was us in our apartments. We had a number of experiences of sort of customers placing a booking and we were running around. I mean, I had to like leave lectures early to go in and let people in to collect a rucksack. And it was all getting a little bit sort of challenging. And we thought, you know, I mean, we'll make this effort because it's our company and we've got something to prove, but I can't imagine just your average person necessarily doing this for people, especially not given the sort of same day nature of bookings. Mm-hmm. So our big challenge then was, okay, how do we make this work? How do we fix this supply issue? And I remember having this discussion in a train station and looking at all the shops around us and wondering, is there something in that? You know, could this be a good way to bring customers into shops? Would they like that? Would they, you know, do they want ancillary revenue? Does this make sense for them? And happily it did. It still took us a while even after that to actually convince the first place to join up. And obviously over time we've refined the pitch. The first lady who signed up her shop, she ran a news agency near my university. And I remember going into pitch her and she said, oh, you remind me of my grandson. I'm gonna give this a shot. And I was like, hey, if that's what works, I'll take it. And it's great because I think once you get one person, as is often the case, it sort of snowballs after that. You've got someone you can take to the next business and say, hey, we've been working with Michelle and she's earned this much money. And, you know, we see this as a way that you could increase your footfall, blah, blah, blah. So that was quite a fun challenge. And that was sort of like early 2016 was when we started doing that. Mm-hmm. And then I had exams and Ant was a little bit busy with work. So we had a couple of months kind of like not really focused too much on it. When we came back in June and we had maybe like sort of 10 businesses on the platform, mm-hmm. we got to the point where we were getting like daily bookings and more than daily bookings. We were sort of getting maybe 5-10 customers a day. And that was when we started to get a little bit excited and think, okay, maybe now is when we need to go raise some money for this.
Yeah. So what was the biggest cost of this at this point?
Do you know what? At that point, we'd only put in, I think, £500 each. So we put in £200 each at the beginning just to kind of build the website. And we used third-party tools to do that, by the way. We found, like, I think it was called ShareTribe. It's this neat little platform that lets you build marketplace, okay. sort of Shopify-esque. And we thought that's a great way to get a sort of MVP product up and running. Neither of us were developers. So, like, we have some technical knowledge, but not enough that we'd necessarily code this whole thing from scratch, which, you know, I'm sure we'll come to this down the sequence of questions. That's been a sort of consistent challenge for us. But in any case, really, it was the running cost of the website, which really wasn't very much per month. the adverts that we were placing on Google just to attract our first customers. Really, the main cost would have been our time, except obviously we weren't paying ourselves anything to do this. So it was, it was really cheap. And I mean, between that initial money and the money we were starting to make off bookings, it wasn't quite profitable, but it was almost at a point where it was just like ticking over by itself. And that was quite nice. But then, you know, we looked ahead and we thought, okay, if this is going to be real, there are going to be obviously more costs than that involved. For one, we wanted to build out our own custom website, and that was going to involve hiring a developer. For another, you know, you look at marketing a little bit more seriously. So we were running Google Ads campaigns that were basically just kind of ticking over day by day, but you can be a bit more aggressive with that. Obviously, at that point, if we're going to go full time on it, we want to pay ourselves a salary that we can survive on. And so, among other things, those were the costs that we started to think about. And we added it all up and sort of budgeted for the year. And we came to this figure of 100,000, which I think was more just the convenience of it being a round number than anything else. But we were like, okay, 100,000 should give us a year of runway if this doesn't go very well. You know, that'll give us a year to test it out. And assuming no one really books, like we'll burn through that money across all these different things. And, you know, then we can call it a day if it's not a success. But 100 grand is what we need to give this a real fair shot.
Okay, so you figured out an estimate for the year. So what did you do to start trying to get that funded?
I'll admit at this point, we got very, very lucky. So we'd been through UCL, which was the university where I did my master's. They had this great entrepreneurship scheme. We'd gone along to a number of seminars that sort of guided us from like sort of idea to business plan. It was a fun program. It was actually a really nice way to structure our thinking about the business. And having done that, we got to this point in the year, it was around June, and we went to the Entrepreneurship Center and we said, hey, we're looking for some advice on how to raise money. And they gave us some good pitch deck templates and said, okay, you want to consider reaching out to, I don't know, various angels or stuff like that. Obviously something we'd never done before. Mm-hmm. So we had to think about it and we thought, let's go for someone in the storage industry. Someone who knows a bit about the industry, but isn't necessarily someone we're going to be like competing with, you know? And we looked at who the big players were in the UK. Big Yellow Storage was the company that stood out. That's the biggest self-storage player in the country. And conveniently, the CEO was an alumnus of Oxford University. So we thought, okay, there's a connection at least. So we sent him an email, just cold email. We found his email address on ceoemails.com, which I still laugh at looking back. It's a genuinely quite useful resource. And we emailed him cold and just said, hey, we went to your uni, we've had this storage idea. You're a storage expert. We'd love to get your advice. And, you know, we're looking for some funding. If any of that interests you, it'd be great to chat. And I mean, what are the chances? Like we sent this one email and he actually replied to us and he said,
wow,
I like the sound of this. Come and meet me in my warehouse. And so we went down to his warehouse a couple of weeks later and we'd worked really hard on this pitch deck. We'd taken the templates and been like, okay, we thought about every aspect of the business, you know, stayed up all night the night before, just like really, not all night literally, but like, you know, we stayed up late really preparing for this big meeting. Went down to his warehouse and he's a very nice guy. And you know, he's still actively involved in the business to this day, which is great. But he gave us this long tour of the warehouse, sat us down and ordered in some sandwiches for lunch and then just like grilled us on the deck, literally slide by slide, picked out every detail, asked us some, you know, questioned us to a degree that we weren't necessarily expecting, but I think we must have held our own well enough because we went away from that meeting thinking, okay, don't know if that's gone well, but good experience. And he emailed us back a few days later and said, guys, I really love this. I want to come on board as an investor. I've got a few criteria that you need to fulfill before I do that, but let's do this. And yeah, honestly, one of the best moments ever.
That's fantastic. Did he offer the full funding amount?
He did initially. And then he said, as one of his criteria, what I'd like you to do is write me a formal business plan. So turn the pitch deck into a written business plan and convince one other investor to join the round. So we were like, okay, we've got the same challenge again. However, in just the same way as we found when we were signing up our first hosts, once you've got one interested party, it became a just amazingly easier sell. Not that we tried particularly hard to sell it. That was the thing. He was the first guy we'd approached. So we had this really, really inflated sense of how easy it was to do this. But the great thing was once he'd expressed interest, we went away and we emailed a few other people that were, you know, angel investor-y types that were sort of friends of friends in our network, just kind of spread our reach as far as we could. And all of those people came back and had conversations with us because he'd expressed interest. And actually, one of the guys was very, very keen, insisted on getting a meeting in with both of us straight away. And the others, you know, we had a couple of phone conversations with other people, all seemed to be pretty positive. But yeah, this one guy, David Prax, was like, I love this. I want to get involved. How soon can we get a meeting together? We got a meeting together with everyone. So it was me and Ant and Jim, who's the CEO of Big Yellow Storage, and David. And David, also David's friend, who was my connection to David, a man called Ian. Anyway, we're all sitting down over this meeting, and the investors at one point, they just turned to us and they said, I think we should do this. This is the deal. We'll offer you the full 100K between us, this valuation. What do you think? So we said, okay, give us a second, and, you know, temporarily left the meeting and looked at each other and we said, we're going to take this deal, right? And we're like, yes, obviously, yes. And then we came back in and we said, okay, cool. Got a deal.
Awesome. So you're set now as far as the funding. How much of a say, how much control did they have over how the business went from then on?
Good question. So that original funding round was for 15% of the company. In terms of like involvement and structure, Jim came on board as a non-executive director, and we had a sort of structure of like X many board meetings per year. I want to say we did a board meeting every 2 months, something like that, while we were getting started. And other than that, you know, Jim was great. I mean, he was always there when we had questions for him, and he came to the board meetings he'd look through all our stuff, and he bounced ideas off us when he had them. But really the nice thing was they were all very happy to just kind of let us run it. They didn't insist on different ways that we should do things. They always listened to our opinions and judgments in terms of the way that we wanted to do things. And by and large, yeah, they were fairly hands-off about it, which was, I think for us, that was a real positive, because I think one of the big things that we came to doing a business together for was the whole learning experience, you know, to educate ourselves about entrepreneurship and learn by doing. And I really think that attitude that they brought to the table really facilitated that big time for us.
Yeah, absolutely. So you have the funding, you have some people on board with you. What was the next step? What changes did you make? What things did you adjust or add, or what was next?
So yeah, 2017. So basically 2016 summer was when we met Jim the first time, and we started getting these meetings together. It took a surprisingly long time for the legal stuff to come through. At least that's how I felt at the time. Subsequent rounds have proved to me that actually 2 to 3 months is pretty normal. So the money lands in our account in December, just before Christmas. Very excited. We go into work on the 2nd of January for our first day full-time together. And yeah, I mean, from then on, we brought in a developer who helped us rebuild the website and do it custom. So they brought that in-house. We set about between ourselves going to sign up more businesses. For a while, that was what we focused on, just because January, February is seasonal low time in terms of travel anyway. Mm-hmm. So we thought, let's use this time to lay the groundwork. And I mean, yeah, we started experimenting with different ways of marketing it, looked at forums, looked at social media. It was a real adventure, and in some ways it all sorts of blurs into this big happy memory of like us just trying to fit together all the different puzzle pieces of running a business. I mean, finance, like learning about our accounting. I made a big mistake at one point in our tax records that bothered me for like months after that. And that was such a learning curve. After that point, we're like, okay, we're not going to do our own accounting. We're going to get accountants. And, you know, there were loads of little moments like that were big learning curves. some really exciting deals that we did as well. We started getting some small hotel chains involved that wanted to come on the platform. And it really, it just sort of really snowballed. And that was 2017. And then the big moment in 2017 came in the summer. We'd been to a conference, like a kind of competition, done fairly well, came second, I want to say. We definitely didn't win it, but I think we came second, and we met some investors there who were quite interested in us. And these were venture capitalists, which was a new breed of investor for us to encounter. A couple of months later, we were chatting to a business advisor, friend of a friend, and he was looking at our model and he said, guys, what you've got here is really scalable, which to be fair was something I'd always loved about the model, is the fact that it's something that, you know, we set out to expand it across England. That was our aim in 2017. Well, the UK, England, Scotland, Wales, Northern Ireland. But then we had this conversation. He was like, there's no reason why Stasia can't exist all around the world. I mean, you can really be doing this internationally. And we're like, okay, cool. That's exciting. You know, I hadn't originally thought that was like the next step, but we started to get quite sold on this idea. And he said, if you're going to do that, you've got to go venture capital money. Venture capitalists will love what you're doing. It's an inherently scalable model. It's tech enabled. Like he said, if I were you, that's 100% what I'd be doing. Because if you don't do that, someone else will have this idea and they'll take that path and they'll beat you to it. And that kind of scared us a little bit. And we're like, oh shit. Sorry, I didn't mean to swear.
No, you're good.
We're like, okay, all right. So fair enough. That's something to think about. And so we kind of changed tack at that point, and we're like, all right, we have 100K in the bank. That's been great. We've almost got to the point where this thing is sort of running just about profitably in the UK, but maybe we should be more aggressive. Maybe we should go down the venture route. And we went back to the VCs that we'd met at the competition, and we chatted to a few others. And we started pitching the idea to these VCs. And that was the whole new experience of pitching. Really much more formal and very different to the kind of angel investing that we'd been looking at the year before.
Okay, this is growing. You start thinking about expanding it internationally. What kinds of stuff did you have to change or to adjust, or things that suddenly entered the picture if you started looking at an international level as opposed to just in the UK?
Well, a big one obviously was like languages and how we were gonna and team at that point, really, because to this point it was still just the two of us and developer. And a funny story. I remember we were in a VC meeting pitching to them, and one of our phones rang, and it was the customer support line, because at that point we were still all the customer support was going through to us. So we were just like, really sorry, we've got to take this, it's a customer. And and I remember coming back from that call, and the guys were like, you should really like hire some people to do that for you.
Yeah.
And we were like, okay, yep, point taken. So we went away and we started hiring some people. And then, the plans at that point started to incorporate, okay, what kind of people are we going to need if we're going to scale this? We need people who, you know, we're going to need full-time salespeople. We're also going to need operations support. We're definitely going to think about marketing internationally and how we like internationalize the website. Definitely at this point going to need a few more developers as well, because just the sheer sort of scale of features that we're going to need to add. So that all started adding up and becoming quite exciting. And the other thing that was interesting was we began to learn a lot more about how venture capital works and the ways that venture capitalists invest and the model that they operate. And actually this is kind of essential knowledge for any startup that's looking to raise VC money, is really understanding the nature of a VC firm and what it is they're trying to optimize. Because for them, the essential goal is all about returning the fund. You need to know what their fund size is. You need to know what they want to make. You need to demonstrate to them as concretely as you can. Obviously, it's all kind of forecasting and speculation, but you need to give them as much hard evidence as possible that this startup that they're going to invest in will more than return their fund, or at least, you know, fully return it, that potential exists. And in a lot of cases, it's okay, because that number isn't quite as heady as the sort of $1 billion investment target that a lot of VCs will talk about. But in practice, I think actually that's the game you kind of have to play. You do have to say, this is the market that we operate in. It's at least a multi-billion dollar market, and we can capture at least $1 billion of that. And that was quite funny for us, I think, especially as British entrepreneurs. We're generally quite modest, I want to say, and overly sort of humble. And we were, you know, I remember in our angel projections, we were saying, okay, this is how we grow this business to be like 1 to 2 million pounds in revenue. And we didn't even really think about what that implied for the company valuation.
Yeah.
And when we were going to VCs, we were like, oh my God, how do we demonstrate that this is like a multi-billion dollar company? And what do those forecasts look like? And that was, I remember being a little bit daunted by that and being like, oh my God, we're just making up numbers here. We're just, we've just basically added zeros onto our last year's model. And, but you know, I think a lot of people, at least a lot of people in Europe possibly do feel that way. And then actually the more you familiarize yourself with that industry, the more it makes sense. And you kind of have to, you know, you recognize that that's the game that you're playing. And you know, that's just the economics of how venture capital works. So yeah, so we started having to really, you know, redo our finances, but happily a lot of conversations went well. That was our first year of sort of experiencing like rejection in terms of investment, because mm-hmm. we had such amazing good luck in the year before, and this year we started seeing VC saying, oh, you know, we're not sure about the unit economics of your model, or we're not sure about the market size. The market size, I think, in our case, was often the biggest challenge, just because it was essentially a new industry, right? We were,
yeah,
no, but we couldn't point to anyone who was already doing international storage, even let alone international sort of luggage storage in that kind of tourism niche. And although we could point to tourism being a massive and growing market, at least pre-pandemic, it was.
Yeah.
You know. It was difficult to sort of ground some of those assumptions in anything concrete. So I think that was the big challenge we faced. However, we were very lucky to find a couple of travel investors who had experience in the industry, liked us and liked what we were doing, and came on board. And so from 2017, raising £100,000, 2018, we raised £1 million. And that felt like a pretty exciting jump to us.
Yeah. Okay. Awesome. So yeah, just keep walking me through what happened, in as you kept expanding and raising the new amounts you needed.
So speaking, as honestly as possible, which I think is the right thing to do for the podcast, 2018 was actually surprisingly quite a tough year. We didn't expect that in terms of, you know, we hit it on such a wave of optimism. 2017 had gone great. We'd raised even more money. We started hiring a team. And that was when new problems started to arise that we hadn't necessarily anticipated. And for one thing, the targets that we'd originally set ourselves were really quite aggressive and optimistic. So January were fine, February were fine. March, we started to dip below our targets. And I think for the rest of the year, we stayed below target. And I remember being really stressed out by that fact. Even though the investors, I remember talking to them later in like the summer, and they said, you know, the targets you originally gave us were so ambitious that we thought if you hit half of these, we'll be happy. So by their measures, we were going okay for most of the year. But for us, we were finding it pretty stressful because we wanted to succeed really quickly in all the new countries that we were launching. And just wasn't as quick as we'd hoped, you know. I remember launching Germany and coming up against the fact that they have a really good train station locker infrastructure, and it was much cheaper than its UK counterparts. So it was way harder to sell the business in Germany. And that was a big section of our model, was just like, okay, Germany is like the same size as the UK, and we expect to be able to do a similar level of business there. So we had to adjust that. That was a bit stressful. The other thing that was a bit stressful was, we decided to go through another website redesign because the custom site that our original developer had built us was good enough for where we were then. It wasn't going to be the right tech to help us scale internationally and as ambitiously as we wanted to. Speaking of that fact, you know, the developer himself, he'd been a great guy to sort of take us from like concept to sort of prototype to initial launch of that, but he definitely wasn't the right guy to lead a team of developers and to be that CTO figure. And so that was another sort of tough learning curve, was navigating that process, deciding ultimately to let him go. And Yeah, just there were a number of actually quite difficult things that it was funny, but we'd kind of breezed through 16, 17 on a high of things just going really well and the direction being up. And although, you know, we still doubled the business 2018 on 2017, we originally set our plans out as being like we were going to quadruple. So we managed to find ourselves disappointed at doubling, and we had all these challenges that came with hiring people and managing those expectations. And I think for both of us, especially considering we were quite young still as founders, that was quite a big, you know, quite a big and quite painful at times learning curve.
Yeah. How many people did you have on your team like by the end of 2018?
I think so. It started off with three of us essentially.
Yeah.
We hired a couple towards the end of 2017 when we first started to expand. And then I think we must have ended up with as many as about 12 at the end of 2018. So yeah, a big shift in company for us from, you know, the initial sort of founders to having a team of people and a kind of structure and a hierarchy and having to think about things like culture that up until then had been somewhat default. It was just, you know, it was just what it was like to hang out as founders. And suddenly we were having to think about that. And actually, definitely that's a big learning curve. I look back on from now is, wow, how important stuff like that is and how deliberate and intentional you have to be about the people that you hire, the people you promote, and the people that ultimately you let go as well. Because those are, I think, the big signals of culture, and it really matters. It's so important, especially in a relatively small team. It's so important to get stuff like that right.
Yeah. Okay, so how did you adjust your goals or your expectations for 2019 based on this, not even a step down because you still doubled, but this the changed expectations, your first real moment of, oh wait, is this not going to do as well as we thought? How did you adjust to that moving forward?
Yeah, and you know, it's funny because I think it's much easier looking back now and thinking doubling was good. I do remember at the time feeling like, you know, there was a point in there were points probably in 2018 where we were like, oh my God, is this thing going to fail? Like, mm-hmm. Yeah. We're already on the sort of downward spiral, which is sort of funny to look back on. But so one of the things we had to do, was just make sure we got the team right. And that involved definitely letting some people go, bringing in a couple of new people. We actually, 2019 was in many ways the best year that we ever had as a company, mm-hmm. but it started quite tough because we came in off the back of 2018 being tricky. We laid out some new targets. Also worth mentioning is, you know, at this point, we'd noticed a number of competitors kind of popping up in 2017, 2018, and they were actually starting to get a bit more serious now. And we're like, okay, we've got serious competition. Some of them are starting to raise money. You know, we really need to up our game. And yeah, it felt like quite a lot of pressure, but I think sometimes you need that. Sometimes that pressure is like good stress and it really motivates you. And so we kind of went back to basics and we were like, okay, what is it we do well as a business? What is it that's essential for us to succeed? And we knew one of our big strengths was selling. That was always the thing that kind of got us started to begin with and helped us to raise the money that was basically giving us the runway to sustain what we felt was quite a down period. And so we went back to selling and we said, okay, partnerships has to be a great way to grow this business. We didn't have that much proven track record of that at that point. We had a few solid partnerships that were referring customers to us. When I say partnerships here, I'm talking about on the demand side. So, mm-hmm. you know, travel businesses, Airbnb hosts, the like, who have customers who need storage and will refer them to us. And 2019, we really started to get that engine working to the point where we're like, okay, we found something repeatable here. Let's hire more salespeople. Here's the template and let's get them working on that. And that started to work really well. Google and SEO was another thing that we really kind of cracked in 2019. Like in 2017, when we had no competition, it was easy. We were just sort of naturally top of Google. 2018, as I said, competitors started to creep in. Things got a little bit tougher. One of Google's rather sudden algorithm changes in the middle of 2018 just like knocked us off the first page for a solid couple of weeks. And that was really stressful.
Yeah.
So in 2019, we were like, okay, fundamentals of SEO, go. What do we do? And we just, you know, sensible actions, step by step. We just broke it down. We're like, okay, we're going to do this, and then we're going to do this, and we're going to do this. And product wise, we had a couple of new developers in, and we're like, okay, this is what we need to focus on. Like, really, let's just make sure everyone who's coming through is converting, and we're making the experience simple, and we're not going to distract ourselves with features that, you know, at different points in 2018, we sort of experimented with because we wanted to, you know, we thought, oh, this idea in this country is a really good idea. And we're like, okay, no, let's, you know, keep things simple. Yeah. And I think ultimately all that really started to pay off. I mean, we started ranking top of Google again. We had these great partnerships referring deals to us. On the supply side as well, we were starting to sell to more hotels. And I think we surpassed 1,000 hosts. That was quite a nice milestone. And we were launching more destinations, but doing really well in the ones that we were already present in. And I think actually come the end of 2019, a little bit stressful because we were starting to run out of money again. Mm-hmm. But on the plus side, we tripled the business 2019 versus 2018. And actually that was the measure that I think we really needed to demonstrate again to investors that this was definitely a sort of VC worthy business. And so kind of solved those two problems simultaneously. Actually, a lot of our existing investors followed on in the round that we did. We brought in some new investors, and end of 2019, early 2020, we closed a £2 million round. And yeah, 2019, just really looking back, I felt like we really turned things around. And it's funny because the difference is 2018 2x'd and 2019 3x'd. But it's amazing, I guess, in the VC business, what a difference that makes to perception, because suddenly we were quite a hot startup again. And I felt like, yeah, 2019, the momentum was really, really with us. You know, we were more disciplined in terms of the people that we brought in and out, and quicker to let people go if we felt that they weren't a good fit. But we also brought in some really excellent people that we felt were, you know, making really positive changes to the business. So yeah, overall 2019, I felt like we really turned things around.
And then 2020 happens.
And then 2020 happens.
So how, you know, and something so based in the tourism industry, how has the year been going?
Yeah, do you know, it's the luckiest thing ever is the timing of that round that we did. So we hit 2020 on probably the biggest high I've ever felt running this business. I remember saying to Ant at different points in January, I remember our employees threw like a surprise party for us just like celebrate the round, and all said, you know, thanks for doing all this work. We love this business, and it's so exciting, like the way it's growing, and thanks to you guys, you know, it's all going really well. And I just, oh man, I remember like I was so touched by that. And just for like a whole week afterwards, I just remember thinking, I think this is the happiest I've ever been. This is just like everything feels like it's really aligned. So the higher the sort of the higher you are, the higher, the further you fall kind of thing. 2020 was tough so far, like, whew, really quite tough. However, the good thing was, one, we had the money in the bank. So at no point this year have we really felt like there's an immediate existential threat to the business's survival. Mm-hmm. Like, yes, demand is extremely low. However, given the state of things, basically we can like hibernate it and put things on pause until they come back. We were a little bit lucky. I think I got given some great advice back in late February when the pandemic was, you know, I think even then it still felt like it was sort of all happening in Asia, hadn't really come to Europe, but that was when people started to sort of talk about that. And I think it had just started to become a problem in Italy. And I talked to one of my advisors and he said, okay, what you've got to do is get out ahead of this thing, make a financial plan that accounts for coronavirus being really negative, and basically show to your investors that you're being proactive and you know, you'll get out ahead of this. Obviously the financial plan that I pulled together was like, okay, we only grow like 1x this year, which is, you know, way off. However, I think the discipline of like reporting cash flow to them on like a more regular basis than we had been doing, I think was a really positive thing. And then I saw Sequoia wrote this great open letter to their founders about how coronavirus could be a sort of black swan. And all the signals kind of started to add up, and we were like, okay, what do we do if you know, if it's really bad and we're like, we can drop people to 4-day weeks, you know, okay, there's some people that we could potentially let go of. Mm-hmm. We can turn off all our AdWords costs. So we figured out ways of like, okay, we can get the spend way, way down in the event that demand kind of dries up. And actually in the end, then that's, you know, we ended up doing all of those things and more. And fortunately in the UK, the government stepped in with this furlough scheme, which entitled us to retain most of the team and have their wages kind of covered by the scheme. And there have been other quite handy initiatives that just help keep you in business, especially if you're in the travel industry. And then I mean, for our part, it sort of does feel weirdly like stepping back in time. I mean, at the moment it's just me and Ant going into the office together again. In September we started going to this little co-working space where we could get a couple of desks just for the sake of being able to work together and see each other. I mean, working from home definitely has its benefits, but I think for us, wow, what a difference it makes to be able to work together. You know, that's a lot of all this was about the fun of working together and being able to do this thing. So that's been really nice. And yeah, I mean, it does feel a little bit like going back in time. As I say, we're kind of running the basic operations again. A lot of customer support is coming back to us. And I mean, we're just trying to focus on the core stuff to some extent, just like keeping the lights on. But it's also been a good chance for us to step back a little bit, look at the business again and think, okay, can we add some new service lines? We've not done anything that's like a sort of full pivot, because I think I still have faith that travel is coming back. I'm not sure when, I'm not sure how long it'll take, but I do think travel is a somewhat fundamental human need. It's kind of core to our experience of being human, and people are still traveling this year. They're just replacing more exotic international travel with staycations and domestic travel. And we're capturing some of that, but it's not really the same, obviously, as the numbers we were seeing. And I think at some point it's coming back. And so that's kind of lent us the strategy of like patience. We're keeping costs really low. We're kind of waiting for things to come back. And in the meantime, we're looking at other things that we can do. So a couple of products that we're working on for hotels to help them get back on their feet. There's a delivery product that we've actually wanted to do for ages, which was, in addition to being able to store your bags, the idea that you could get them shipped or delivered to anywhere you want.
Oh, nice.
Internationally or in the city. And you know, that's something that's actually, it was in our first ever business plan that we wrote for Jim way back when in 2016 that we'd never really got around to because the core business was keeping us busy enough. But actually it's been quite fun to have the time to invest in setting that up. And and then, I mean, I guess the other thing was we'd worked so hard in 2019 that there was actually something quite refreshing about the time off that this has given us. And obviously I'd rather have that time off in circumstances where the whole business environment is more stable. And frankly, like the whole geopolitical social environment is more stable. I mean, I just, you know, a lot of what's happening does make you feel a little bit concerned for the future in general for everyone. But but there are silver linings to every cloud. And I think the way that we've looked at it is that, you know, the best thing we can do right now is keep practical and kind of make the most of the new time that we have on our hands, really.
Yeah, absolutely. I would imagine that your biggest challenge right now is just dealing with this situation. But overall, in the whole process of funding and planning and developing this startup, what has been either a consistent challenge or something that was really especially personally difficult for you? What's been a big challenge that you were confronted with that you feel like you figured out how to overcome and move past?
It's a tough one. I don't mean this in a negative way at all, but I think people is definitely consistently a challenge, and that can be for good and for bad reasons. But I think even, do you know what, I mean, one of the things I love about doing this as a co-founder is that I've always got Ant to sort of share the highs and the lows with, and especially times like this year where it's really stressful. It is such a weight off your mind to know that someone else is going through this with you, like exactly the same things, and his fortunes are tied up in exactly the same way. However, even that, you know, there's just working with people, even like your best friend, like Ant, is has its sort of moments of stresses as well. And that's, I mean, that's fine. That's something that we have years and years of knowing each other to handle and have experience with. But then you start adding more people into the equation, and the number of relationships within the organization magnifies, and you just get all sorts of new and unpredictable problems. And even the guys who do really well and you think are just fantastic, they'll have issues around, like, you know, okay, I'm doing really well. What's my progression look like? and you know, you start to worry about, like, don't want them to go anywhere. You know, you want to make sure that they're compensated well enough so that they don't leave, because they're really valuable. And then on the other hand, you've got people who just don't quite gel with the company, don't quite fit, or don't seem to be working hard enough. Or you're like, how do I sort of motivate them to get this? Or how do I get them to understand the way that I'm coming at this issue? And, you know, to some extent, I kind of love it. I love working with people. Personally, I found the working from home aspect of the pandemic a little bit challenging in that respect, because I just, I miss the vibe and the energy you get from being around people and, you know, ideas buzzing around and just like the fun of it, the atmosphere. So I really enjoy the challenges that working with people throws up, but definitely that would be, I think that would have to be my answer in terms of like what is consistently a challenge. The only other one would be Google. Google is consistently a mystery in terms of SEO and what it wants and the power that it wields. Yeah. But no, I think serious answer would be that. I think raising money is a challenge, but I think we've been very lucky and we've had quite a good ride of that. And I think there's a, you know, there are people more experienced than me who have sort of much good advice on this all around the net that you can find. And I mean, the same is true for dealing with people, but I think no matter how good you are at the theory of that, the practice of specific people and individual issues will always be unique to every startup. And I think no matter how good a manager you are, you're always going to come up against stuff that's kind of unexpected in that domain.
Yeah. As kind of a companion question to that, you know, people talk about wanting to launch their own business. I'd love to know, for you personally, what is your favorite thing about this startup? Like, what is the thing that you're just like, yes, this is exactly what I wanted to do, and this is why?
I really think, I think the autonomy for me is what I love the most. And do you know what? More than ever this year, I think I've really come to appreciate that, because we have good relationships with all our investors. I think the fact that we were out ahead of the curve with the pandemic really helped us. But for the most part, they haven't put too much pressure on us. They've really just kind of let us get on with it and trusted us to deal with the situation appropriately. And they read and react to our monthly updates. And I love that. I love the fact that I can go into work every day and I'm like, okay, what's the big problem I want to solve today? Like, what challenges are we facing? How do we want to tackle it? Like, how do we want to spend our time? What's the best way to do that? And, you know, that's, I really love that. And I mean, I don't have that much to compare it to apart from like being at school and being set like specific assignments and homework and feeling like you kind of just, you're doing things because you have to. But I think being able to dictate your own agenda and manage your own time is something that I think I really enjoy. And actually, I think I've got better at in the sense that definitely there have been points, especially 2019, where I was working extremely hard, possibly because I just like felt I had to sort of prove, you know, how good this thing could be and felt this real sort of need to do that. But this year, I think because that kind of pressure has been lifted, I've really felt the sort of benefits of being in charge of your own time and being able to manage when you work and set exactly what you work. And I think on reflection, that is a major perk of being an entrepreneur.
Yeah. All right. So my final question before kind of winding down into actual final question. Do you or did you have for yourself like a moment in time that would be your definition of this is successful? Did you have a line that you're like, once we hit this, this is where, and obviously that, you know, that changes as businesses grow and as new goals appear. But did you have a moment where you felt like you had crossed over from still, I don't know what I'm doing yet and still trying to get things going to success? And if not, where do you think that is?
I think we've had a few actually. And I think it's a really good question and an important one, because I think it's tempting, as you say, the goals, like new goals appear. It's like the goalposts are kind of, if you let them, they just constantly move forwards and you're always chasing them. And that's a great thing. You know, that's kind of, I think it's human nature, right? You set yourself a challenge and you're constantly sort of reaching for more and stretching higher. But it's also obviously at the same time, I think for your personal happiness, really important to reflect on when you've hit goals that you have set before. And definitely one of the big moments was when we raised that first funding round and the £100,000 landed in the bank. And I do remember thinking, do you know what? No matter if this fails, no one can ever take away the fact that we had this idea and we raised this money for it. And we're going to have this, this time ahead where we get to work full time on it. So that was a moment where I vividly remember feeling that. And I think, again, the same feeling happened in 2017 when we just hired our first two people and we had this meeting all together and we all just went to the pub and I was like, wow, this is another like real moment in time experience where we've gone from being founders and now we've hired these people. And again, this is a moment that no one can sort of take away from you once it's happened. Like, we've grown the startup to the point that we've employed people. That's cool. That's really exciting. And then definitely as well, I think I'm trying to remember if there was a specific one. We've had milestones in the past where, like, I remember when we launched our 100th city, for example, which possibly is one we should have celebrated more. But I remember that was one where I was like, wow, that's pretty cool. That's a nice achievement. And when we passed 1 million in revenue as well, again, another time where we're like, okay, cool. That's another, you know, it's a distinct milestone. It's something that you can definitely celebrate. And I guess there've been moments too, where we've like entered various competitions and we won them. We won a pitch competition that took place literally in Buckingham Palace. That was really cool. So yeah, there've been a lot of highs on the way. And I think it's all too tempting to kind of look past them at like, what's the next challenge? What's the next challenge? I think that's definitely in our nature to do that. But yeah, especially this year where I've had quite a bit of time on my hands, it is quite fun to look back on those moments. And I don't know, it's hard to see what the next ones are going to be specifically. I think when we start seeing people travel again and we have a clear idea of what the new normal quote unquote will look like, we'll be able to set more specific goals then. Certainly for us, I think just getting the new services up and running is an exciting new goal. It's something that's keeping us occupied. But no, yeah, it's a really interesting question.
Yeah. Awesome. Then, as we kind of wind things down, I typically end my podcasts a similar way. I ask whoever's speaking to us to address the two types of people who might be listening in our audience. One being somebody who is never going to have this experience, is never going to found a startup, doesn't really have an interest in it, but would still benefit from learning, from knowing something about the process, maybe clearing up a misconception or saying, hey, you should know this about this. And on the flip side, you have folks who either are in the middle of this or are considering this. Maybe somebody who has an idea but hasn't really gotten started. And I'd love for you to give a piece of advice to them, something to hold on to moving forward. So somebody without any experience in this, somebody with a little bit, what would you say to each of them?
Okay. I think someone with no experience, what I would say is, I think it's tempting to imagine there are so many more barriers to actually getting started than there really are. And whether or not it's something you're ever going to actively pursue, I think a big learning for us was that actually a lot of those barriers are kind of imaginary. Like, I remember thinking there must be so much administration that just goes into setting up a new business. And actually, you could set up a new business today for £13 in the UK. You literally create a registration at Companies House, and that's it. you're suddenly a businessman. And and obviously, you know, there's more that goes into it in practice. But my point there is just that a lot of the sort of obstacles that we imagine are somewhat imaginary. The reality is very much quicker. On the other hand, I think it's sort of tempting to think that, you know, you need to have, let's separate these two because they are different pieces of advice. And actually the second piece goes well to the people who have started or have an idea. I think it's very tempting and a mistake that we sort of made originally and were lucky enough to somewhat pivot from is to think that like everything that matters is the idea. And I think especially when you're new to the world of business, and I remember thinking this a lot when I was like a teenager, is that it all comes down to the idea. The idea is sort of fundamental. And obviously ideas matter a lot. They're the kind of starting point, the threshold. However, loads of people have loads of ideas. What really matters is the execution. I mean, you could have a brilliant idea or a terrible idea, and to some extent it doesn't matter, because once you start working on it, you do find that you naturally will try and pivot towards something that does work. And in our case, when we had this Airbnb for storage model in people's homes, and it just never quite clicked, but it gave us enough to get working on the model that worked in businesses, and that does have scale and potential. And I think my big piece of advice to those guys, especially if they've started out, is to persevere a little bit, but be smart about it. Don't feel so attached to an idea that you overlook the way that people actually interact with it. Like, be mindful of what customers want and what they're telling you. And especially because sometimes customers aren't great at giving you feedback in words, like look at their actions as well and look at the way they're really behaving and interpret from that, you know, real wisdom about your product and your service. Because it's tempting to pin an awful lot on the idea, and actually what you find the further into business you get is that really it's the execution that matters so much more.
Yeah, no, I think that is great. Awesome. Before we officially close out, Jacob, I want to give you a chance to plug anything of your own. Obviously tell us, you know, anything that would be useful about your business for anybody who might be traveling in the near future. But also any other personal projects or social media, anything that you want to share?
Thank you. Yeah. So definitely go check out Stasher. Next time you're traveling, I mean, we're in 250 cities, so chances are we're somewhere near where you're going. Our apps are on the Play Store and the App Store, free to download, but also you'll easily find us online at stasher.com. And warmly encourage you to check us out next time you go traveling, especially if you're going to find yourself in a situation where you don't have luggage. Where you have luggage. And
you don't have luggage space or storage.
Yes, exactly. So especially if you find yourself needing store luggage on your travels. And other than that, I'm not overly active on social media, I must be honest. I love LinkedIn as a sort of tool for work, especially in networking. So yeah, please, if you like this episode, do reach out to me on there. I'm more than happy to chat to anyone and connect with anyone who wants to have an interesting conversation. And then the only other project to promote would be Anthony and I, during the quiet of lockdown, set up a podcast of our own. It's called The Morality of Everyday Things. And that podcast actually is somewhat unrelated to Sasha. It's a kind of everyday philosophy podcast in which we look at modern day moral issues and just discuss them really and dig into them and kind of unpick, okay, how should we think about this? How do we feel about this? And it's not even really us just like saying what we think so much as just like how to think about these issues. And we've looked at some pretty interesting stuff lately, lockdowns being a key one, looked at whether billionaires should exist. That's been a lot of fun. And again, that's on basically every major streaming platform, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, etc. The Morality of Everyday Things. Yeah, please do check that out as well if that sounds interesting to you.
Yeah, absolutely. That sounds fascinating to me. I'm going to have to look that up.
Cheers.
Awesome. Well, thank you so, so much for being willing to come on and share your experience. I've learned a lot. This has been a really interesting conversation. So thank you so much.
Oh, thank you. No, you've been a great host. This has been a lot of fun.
Awesome. All right, folks, that's our episode. You can come back next week and we'll have a different interview with somebody else about something completely different. And we will see you then.